Blog Talk Radio.
Jonathan Xavier, inasmuch as you insist on being an outsider and laughing at the rules and traditions of our advanced civilization, I am exiling you to a place which has no adherence to either. I have no choice but to sentence you to Earth.
Interlude. I've been in that godforsaken desert for 40 days and 40 nights, all to get away from Johnny and his pack of jackals.
Where is she?
What's up with Johnny? What's he waiting for?
We mean planet Earth for what it's worth, but there's other planets to explore.
Flying saucer.
Mickey O'Flynn, the man with the grin, is missing.
Oh, my God. I might not think.
I want to tell the whole world that I'm alive.
How do you think you came back?
A message for the people, and I'm in need of a medium.
You'll always be an extra large to me, Mickey.
Why do they not believe? I'm not lady in the bed. No one can conceive. Will I become the loving kid? I would not fall in love like this. I would not fall in love like this.
Welcome to another edition of Archivist Beds on Sexy Witches, a podcast from the Geek Girls' perspective, and I am the head actress, and we once again have an amazing show for you tonight. We have been on a roll with our guests this season. I actually think this probably is one of the best seasons of Sexy Witches we've had in a long time. In the second hour at 10 o'clock tonight, we are going to have actor, producer, editor, digital renaissance man, and even spiritual leader. We will have the actor started in trauma and is going on from there, Will Keenan. Please, and it's kind of amazing because I had his director for Johnny X, which trailer displayed, in the very first season of Archivist Beds on Sexy Witches 8 years ago. So, this is coming full circle and kind of fucking neat. So I can't wait to talk to him. But first, let me introduce my sexy witches! Starting in the Los Angeles area, two of my sexy witch co-hosts are there. One is the Enchantress of Nevermore. Please welcome to the show, Raven Jasper Hawk. How you doing? Welcome. Woo-hoo. You're on with the sexy witches.
What's up, witches?
What's up? And by the way, I'm so happy. Thank you for bringing him on the show. This is wonderful.
Yeah,
I feel like I'm living in a dream. I just thought I'd try, like, hey, buddy, what if you came on this podcast? And he's like, okay.
He fangirling like a motherfucker, man. I'm so happy for you. So let me come back to you in just a minute because we have a few more people on the line. Please welcome my cousin, my partner in crime at media conventions, my Star Wars nerd extraordinaire. Please welcome the Warlock of Orange County, Eric Hogan. Hello, you're on with the Sexy Witches.
Hello there.
Hello there. You know what I mean?
That was my lame-ass Ewan McGregor attempt.
Oh, well, you know. We will have to talk about Ewan McGregor tonight, for sure, on the first hour. We have much to discuss about Star Wars. And also, in the Atlanta area, my voice of violence. We'll talk a little pro wrestling tonight, even tonight. My son of celluloid, the dirty southern sorcerer himself. Please welcome to the show, Nathan Hamilton. Hello, sir. You're on with the Sexy Witches.
Hello, ladies, gentlemen, everything in between. I'm glad to be here. Let's get geeky.
Let's get geeky. We have an hour to kill before our guests, so we're going to talk about some of the things we've done and watched because there is so much. This is such a nerdy summer. We talked about it last episode, how much stuff is dropped. Like this week, Umbrella Academy dropped for people who care about that.
Yeah.
There is so much nerdy stuff happening, and it is a beautiful time to be a geek. I mean, not only that, in August we're getting a Game of Thrones spinoff and Lord of the Rings. What the fuck, guys? This is like a living in a nerd renaissance. But first, we have some business to take care of, Sexy Witches, because back in our Madness show, our theme announcement, we had the wonderful indie director, Bobby Easley, and
been hanging around me too long.
Yeah, I guess so. talking about his first, he's done feature films before, but he actually had Brian Yuzna produce his movie Dream House, which was the H.P. Lovecraft version of Dreams of the Witch House. It actually is dropping next week on streaming platforms for everyone to see. And he gave us a screener, thank you, Bobby, to watch his show.
Yes.
So, who go first? I'm not going first.
That was scary. I'll go.
Okay, cool.
I'll get it out of the way, and then I can't get blamed on copying anyone. So... First of all, I watch everything with captions, and I like judging movies on the first three captions that happen. The first three captions of Witch House were squelching, followed by another squelching, followed by ominous orchestral music. And I really think that sets the tone for what you're about to get into. The music is actually, the scoring is actually really good. The credit music, like those are bitching credits, right? In general, Lovecraft adaptations can come off as rather dry, but I don't think this one did. I thought there was some new life. It's not a lot of times, like I've been to the Lovecraft Festival a few times and it's like, okay, how many times are we going to remake Dagon? It's right. A lot of the same stuff. And, it didn't feel stale, and I really liked the music, and I really liked the color lighting palette that he used. A lot of stuff looked like almost night vision goggles, but it wasn't. It was more ethereal than that. It was pretty cool.
When Nathan was watching it, he recognized a couple people that had actually been on his panels at Days of the Dead.
Yeah,
oh, wow.
That tends to happen with independent horror films. I know the lead actress. I know some other people that popped up in it, we'll go with Portia. She's kind of credited as one on her IMDb and one in the credits, but Michelle or Portia, whatever, gave a really good performance as the lead. Like I was very impressed with hers. And I've said before when I have reviewed Bobby's movies that his strong point is atmosphere. Always has been. He knows how to set a mood and carry it through a movie.
Yeah.
And that was exactly what the number one thing that struck me about this movie was just the atmosphere he was able to create and the tension he was able to maintain.
Yeah, it was really uncomfortable in spots, too. He was really good at creating, like, this awkward... my favorite interaction is the character who's immediately, his first line is like, have you found the Lord? Have you found Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior? And she's just like, I need to get something out of my car, which is how I feel like when anyone asks me that, too. just nice and awkward.
I actually found it interesting that even though this is a direct adaptation and pretty relatively faithful, I would say, in spirit to the source material of Dreams of the Witch House, that it was, first of all, a female lead. Also, there's a little bit more sex than most Lovecraft movies have. So we even had we had demon sex in this movie. Spoiler alert. That's always a positive.
Demon sex, always a positive.
Right?
That's right.
That could be the blurb.
That's a t-shirt right there.
I mean, there's always a slight element of body horror in Lovecraft, especially when there's tentacles involved, but this one in particular had a lot of body horror in it.
Yeah.
Actually looking forward to watching it again during the madness. Because there's some ATB, I think, going to be happening.
Oh, yeah. Actually, there were absolutely sexy witches in that one. And I probably will
give a
special for it. So, an elder god. Well, he wasn't really an elder god. He was a straight-up good old-fashioned devil demon. That was one of the things that we were complaining about. You know, there's a couple of rules. And we don't mean this negatively, but like when we were watching it, there's a couple of rules you just don't do. If you're ever forced to move up into an attic, A, don't open the goddamn book. She does that immediately.
And then reads from it.
And then she draws chalk pentacles on the ground. You know that's never going to lead to anything good. Never. Like, you know, that you want to raise elder demons, that's how you raise elder demons. The only criticism I want to give Bobby's movie is I wish they lit the demon himself a little bit better. There's a really good makeup job on that guy. Like, there was some really nice masks and makeup all through this movie. And he was the only one that was really shadowed up, and you really didn't get a good look at him until the credits. And I kind of wish I could have had more time with the devil monster himself and looked at him a little closely, more closely. But other than that, I'm so happy for Bobby that he has, like, this movie out there and people are going to see it. And, you know, I always root him on in anything he does. He's a sweetie. He was one of the first people I met at Days of the Dead myself. Him and So Long, who is the rat guy in the movie. I knew that guy.
I like how they do that character.
Yeah, the rat guy was pretty cool.
The way they make the switch back and forth, like just seemingly at random, that's really good use of that character.
So hooray to Bobby. And Bobby, we love you, and please come back on the show whenever, and we will make sure during the madness that we're going to give a special for your film and force a bunch of motherfuckers to watch it. So that'll be awesome. Anything else we want to say about Bobby's movie before we talk of more pop culture? Because we got a lot of pop culture to talk about.
Can you remind us where it will be available? Has he told us yet?
I am not exactly sure. To be honest with you,
Bobby, we need
Bobby,
the info.
Bobby, if you're listening, what platforms?
Sure, freaking Dan.
Let me ask him real quick and see if he's online. He might be listening. Oh my God, they're
awesome.
Fucking up my review.
How are we supposed to plug your shit if we don't know where it is?
Bobby, what platforms? I think one of them was Amazon Prime, but I could be wrong.
You know what? I've got an app for that.
Hey, Bobby, what platforms is your film on? Okay, so I wrote that, and I can go to Witch Houses. There is a Witch House Witch House app. I mean,
Facebook
page. And I believe, I'm not sure, but there was supposed to be a drive-in screening at the Phipps Drive-In in Indianapolis, but I'm not sure that's actually happening now because they didn't have time to put the whole movie in. So I'm not sure. But it is playing for sure at Gen Con this year, and it's going to play at the Days of the Dead in Indianapolis in July. So you'll be able to see it at those festivals for sure. But yeah, I think the Phipps one, unfortunately, I think was canceled. Let's see. I'm trying to see. I'm scrolling. So please, if you want more information, go to H.P. Lovecraft's Witch House Facebook page. He's been posting a lot talking about his movie, and other people have been reviewing his film as well. There's a Sexy Witches podcast called Witch Lore Podcast, which I might have to talk to these people on YouTube, and they reviewed his film. So I definitely want to talk to him. Let's say add to watch list. Let's see what we got here. In the Horror Witch House, inspired by Lovecraft. Links in bio. Let's see. Okay. These are all reviews.
The festival is incredibly fun.
Yeah, well, Gen Con is the biggest gaming festival in the world. So you'll have a pretty large audience for that there. So that's always a good thing. And, of course, Days of the Dead in Indianapolis is, you know, his go-to horror convention because he is from that
Days
area.
Days of the Dead,
so.
July 22nd through 24th. Gen mm-hmm. Con, August 4th through 7th.
Yep.
Blah, blah, blah. Okay.
Yeah. I actually don't know what – I keep scrolling through to see if I can see what platforms. There's a fuck ton of podcasts out there, though, so listen to Bobby talk about his movie. We're all reviewing it. So congratulations, Bobby. Yeah. We love you. So moving on. But
yes.
Today I made Nathan get up early and watch the finale of Obi-Wan Kenobi. And I know that Mr. Aaron is probably already watched it as well.
What? Yes.
Yes, okay. So, the gentlemen, even though this is my Sexy Witch podcast, I'm going to give you the floor to nerd it up. We are going to give spoilers, so massive spoiler alert, especially if you're into the EU or the Clone Wars or any of that kind of stuff. This is going to be a spoilerific few minutes, but the floor is yours, gentlemen. Obi-Wan the shit out of our show.
Groovy. You want to jump in first, or should I?
Obi-Wan. I like that Obi-Wan is used as a verb. That was cool. You go right ahead, my friend.
Well, where to begin? There are people saying that this is flat out the best Star Wars prequel material that we've been given. It's kind of hard to argue with that. Deborah Chow, the director, is amazeballs. I would like to join the chorus saying, please give Deborah Chow more Star Wars. She knocked it out of the park on Mandalorian. She knocked it out of the park here. I guess to go back to basics, we should talk about Obi-Wan himself. He was rated the single most popular Star Wars character with 500,000 votes on Rotten Tomatoes. So, yeah, you could say he's got a fandom. You know, Obi's got a posse. As far as the series itself goes, I'm biased. I was one of the first guys to see it at Star Wars Celebration. They did the premiere live with the cast, which was kind of amazing. From John Williams' purportedly last main theme score for Star Wars to the fucking ending, which, you know, again, spoilers. There's another Jedi that comes back. You know, it's a ghost Jedi. And the thing, I guess, if I had to encapsulate what I loved the most out of all this is what fan service there wasn't forced even once, no pun intended. I loved the performances out of everybody. I loved Flea's little thing in there. I was a little dubious about Kumail in there, but you know what? He was great too, and everything. It wasn't a laugh riot. It was a little darker, a little more somber, a little more beaten down. Obi-Wan, no, just Ben, please. But it really has some wonderful peaks and valleys, and overall, just a great series that I am going to enjoy watching again and probably again.
You know, one thing I found interesting was back when Boba Fett came out, a lot of people were calling it, that were making it like out to be a Star Wars Western. This was every bit a Star Wars Western. Like, Obi-Wan was Shane in this series, like 100%. This gunslinger who had hung up his lightsaber, but he had to come back for one last favor for someone he loved. It's a perfect Western. It's a perfect outer space Western.
I told a
good encapsulated story. Like, it might be the best prequel footage we've gotten so far. There are two fight scenes, I think, that give the whole story of this whole thing. And yes, here we go into spoiler mode, but I'm not going to do it too bad. There's one between two Sith, I'll say that. One of them's Darth Vader. And the way he uses the Force in a lightsaber duel in ways we haven't seen before is so badass. Like that fight scene might be my favorite lightsaber duel since the original trilogy. But then in the finale, you have a Jedi rock fight.
Yeah.
That was a little bit silly for me.
Really?
Yeah, the rock fight, I was just like, okay, throw a rock at him here or there, but the full-on rock fight, I didn't dig. But
oh, come on. Empire was all about throwing crap at Luke.
Well, true. Very true. No, not literally, though.
Yeah. Let me give an alternative thing, and then I'll let you jump on your jam. But when I saw all those rocks behind Obi-Wan, I knew, wow, that's going to be an iconic shot for people from now on. I'm going to see that screen captured and everywhere. And next Star Wars Celebration, I'm going to see paintings of that because it was awesome and chilling. And now I'll let you do your alternative viewpoint.
Okay. The way I feel, there were really only two things that kind of made me in the finale. It was that, and there was one moment. Let me ask you, but was there a moment that really kind of smacked a little too much of something that happened on Clone Wars? Almost the exact same shot, even.
There were a couple lines of dialogue and poses. Reminded me of things, but I couldn't. No, I can't think of what you're thinking of specifically.
But yeah, there was one that we'll talk about it off air. But okay. those two things. Other than that, the finale was great. However, the episode right before the finale was flawless. That is one of the best single episodes of any television series I have seen in forever.
Yeah,
like that penultimate episode was so damn good.
What did you think of the duel between Obi-Wan and Padawan Anakin that we kept going back to in flashback?
The duel looked good, except for the de-aging on Hayden Christensen.
Yeah.
But the,
which didn't look like much.
The actual duel itself was very well done.
Yeah, I thought so too.
And I know you're a Clone Wars fan too. I think they did a good job of making him fight like Anakin fought on the show.
So much so. And at Celebration, Ewan talked about how Hayden Christensen had some moves that he used with the lightsaber and everything. And they actually traded a little bit of fight choreography, things that he used to do back then. He was now doing his Obi-Wan and versa vice. The other thing that I have to mention, because you made me think of it just now, there are 30 to 40 unproduced Clone Wars scripts. How about a live-action Clone Wars with these two? Huh?
I'd absolutely be down for that.
Oh.
Give it to us,
Star Wars.
Give it to us now.
I was gonna say, it sounds like you guys need Kleenex. Careful there.
One thing I think was the smartest thing they did on this whole show was they got a cute little girl to play little girl Princess Leia. So now they have a marketable Disney Princess Leia.
Yep. And
that was one of the smartest freaking story moves they could have made.
Droid they gave her.
Oh, they're going
to
sell a million
crap.
Of those.
How cute is that? I've got a story to tell you about Star Wars Celebration and that little droid, too, but I'll save that for another time.
Oh, you know, I have no problems with my Princess Leia Disney princess at all, you know.
Right?
So the holster and all that was awesome. I do want to say there was one true great moment I thought in the finale, and it's at the end of the lightsaber duel, and they're talking that exchange that Obi-Wan and Darth has at the very end of the show was so good. But what made it great was how they blended Hayden Christensen and James Earl Jones' voice together in that sequence. So they would go back or you would hear them at the same time. And that I watched that scene twice. It geeked me out. I didn't hate the rocks as much as Nathan did. But I want to point out there's a difference between the Empire moment and the rock moment. In the Empire moment, Darth is not trying to kill Luke Skywalker. He's just proving a point.
Off the God blessed platform, yo.
Yeah, well, he knows it's not going to kill him.
It could've.
But you know, these guys have history . I made the joke, you know, there's nothing kind of like having a rock in your hand sometimes, you know, bashing someone upside the head with a rock. You know, it is what it is. But I also agree with Nathan. I thought the fifth episode was my favorite episode of the season. I thought that was a pretty solid episode from beginning to end. Felt like true Star Wars. And watching Darth Vader, like, passive-aggressive sword fighting was incredible. You know, it was like, wow, this, you know, the true moment. Raven, did you bring you in a little bit here? Did you see the finale yet?
I have not seen the pilot yet.
I figured.
What?
I'm a little bummed.
It's fine. It's actually a really short binge because most of the episodes are under 40 minutes, with the exception of the final one, which was only 15 minutes. Yeah. These were really short friggin' episodes. That's one negative maybe. They said that there was like a rumor that the final episode was going to be super long, kind of like what Stranger Things was doing, but it was only 50 minutes, so it's pretty friggin' short. One more thing about Star Wars news, and then we're going to move on. They announced today that they are making a new series, and it's for Cal Kestis, The Fallen Order, and he's going to get a TV series. So,
And it has been rumored for a while, and this one's going to be live action.
So let's see what happens there.
Let me ask one more question on Kenobi before we move on. Is your opinion on a season two?
Both Hayden and Ewan said they'd love to. So, this has done great numbers for Disney, and the critical biosphere has been overwhelmingly positive. So fingers crossed.
I don't know if I want them to do a season two.
I'm not sure I want them to do one either. I thought it was a good standalone.
You can draw.
Yeah, but you can go backwards. You don't have to, go forward with it. There's so many possibilities.
You can draw such a perfect story, line in the story from the end of this miniseries and Help Me, Obi-Wan, You're My Only Hope. Like, the line between those two is perfect. Like, take the money you would put for a second season of this and put it for another project and just leave that perfect link alone.
That's a valid point. And we should mention Cal Kestis is originally from the video game Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order.
Yeah, that's why I said Fallen Order, but I forgot it was. Yeah, so yeah, good. But yeah, good,
it originally started as a video game.
This series is going to have so much platforming.
So
no doubt.
Let's see. I had a bunch of stuff. Now I don't even remember what I'm going to talk about. One thing I wanted to say, and Raven will bring you in on this one, is that I don't know if you noticed that Joe Bob's new season, once again, has been killing it with the choices he's been making. He showed Tenebrae the other day, which makes me so happy. And he showed, Stepfather? And, you know, he's been, like, showing a lot of, like, once again, he's doing the world good. And yesterday they announced the lineup for Jamboree, which is going to be in Memphis this year. They are showing, I'm trying to find all the information, but they are showing on Saturday night, they're showing two films that are music-based. One, they're doing Rock and Roll High School with PJ Souls in attendance. And then they're also showing Bubba Hotep for the anniversary. So that is
Saturday night,
and they're going to have an Elvis concert impersonator that night.
Before Rock and Roll High School, they're having a Ramones cover band.
That's right, they are.
Nice.
The Friday night, Darcy is programming it, and she's doing a retrospective or a live commentary, it sounded like, of Season of the Witch.
Oh, wow.
The Halloween 3, which is, has a lot of issues with it, but I believe like the main cast and the director, you know, Tom Atkins and the chick from it and the director are going to be there in attendance live for that. And then Sunday is always the indie lineup. He did not announce the indie lineup, but he did announce the fan meet and greet that is accompanying it. And he has a lot of great people, obviously, already there. But one of the people that stood out for myself and Nathan is the wrestler Danhausen is going to be there. And, you know, Danhausen is kind of this gothic, you know, alien creature on
interdimensional being.
Yeah, so, you know, that Danhausen, and he's going to, like, he's also a huge nerd and an action figure collector. So it's like, whoa, so that's at the Hilton nearby, and this is all in Memphis, Tennessee at the Mako Drive-In, which is a very famous drive-in. So the Jamboree is going to be awesome again this year. Last year it was at the Mahonic in Pennsylvania. So, close, oh so close, yet oh so far from here.
even if you're not a wrestling fan, go look up Danhausen's stuff on YouTube. He's got, like, toy unboxing videos and all kinds of, and a vlog and all kinds of stuff. And he's basically like a horror host that randomly wandered into a wrestling show. Like, that's basically him.
That's kind of how it is. But yeah, it looked amazing. The pop culture convention. Let me get details on who's all gonna be there. Dun 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 dun. Okay, so we got all the staff, of course, from the drive-in show. Come on, where's the rest of them? We have this John Brennan, Tom Atkins, like I said, Stacey Nelkin. I always forget her name. That's the from Season of the Witch. Tommy Lee Wallace, the director of Season of the Witch. Fred Williamson, the Hammer himself, is going to be there. Sybil Danning's going to be there. PJ Souls is going to be there. Danhausen and two other AEW wrestlers, Blade and the Bunny. And I believe Blade is a horror geek. So it would make sense that he'd be there. So, so the pop culture convention that accompanies it is going to be fantastic. Once again, Joe Bob just knocking it out of the park. Raven, you've watched this season of Joe Bob, and how you been feeling about it this year?
I've really liked it. It's been very strong. And the only thing I hadn't liked, and this is just like such a nerdy complaint, is so far until this most recent show, I had seen every single movie already. And when you watch as many horror movies as we do, it's going to happen. You're going to start to run out. However, this weekend, I had never seen The Mutilator, and I had only seen the stupid remake of The Stepfather with Amber Heard in it. But I had seen a documentary about the murder that they used for the plot of The Stepfather. So I was already familiar with that background going into it. So it was really interesting to see, like, what they used from the actual true crime. And I was really interested in that part when Joba was talking about, like, the history of what really happened, this real murder that happened, and how that turned into The Stepfather. I found that really is fascinating.
And you guessed it was going to be Stepfather from the clues Darcy and Joe Bob were giving online.
I don't think I did.
Oh, I thought you had.
I think I saw Amityville.
Oh, okay.
I think you did say Amityville.
Yeah.
That would have been a good guess, and I might be smoking crack here, but I swear he did Stepfather already. I swear I watched an episode with him, but I could be wrong. So like I said, I could be smoking crack. He announced two guests for the upcoming episode. Charlie Band and Larry Fessenden are going to be on this week's episodes of Drive-In. And I'm like, wow. So I'm hoping they do subspecies, because a bunch of Charlie Band movies dropped on Shudder, I noticed, including three of the Puppet Master movies and a couple other ones. But subspecies would be the one that I would hope he would show people. So, you know, it's by far one of Charlie Band's strongest films. And The Last Winter dropped also on Shudder, which is Larry Fessenden's best movie as a director. But who knows if he's being used as a director or an actor in this case. So I'm hoping it's Last Winter. That would be a really weird combination, so Species and The Last Winter both have monsters in them. But Last Winter is going to be prominent for the madness this year because it has a Wendigo in it. So, you know, Wendigos are awesome. So other things we need to talk about. What else do we have to talk about?
The head hauntress and I saw two animated movies that could not have been more different. The first we went and saw Bob's Burgers, which is exactly what it needs to be. It's an hour and a half long episode of Bob's Burgers.
It's
a good episode.
It had full production numbers in it.
Yeah.
Like three of them.
It's exactly what you think it is, and it's exactly what it needs to be, and it's exactly what you want. So if you're into Bob's Burgers, see it. You'll dig it. We also went and saw Mad God.
Right.
And would you like to speak on Mad God?
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, I went to the Plaza for the first time to see it. The Plaza is the big art house here in Atlanta, and I finally got to go
and open
film
since 1933.
Yeah, and so it was kind of a killer venue to go see a movie like this in. That Tippett has been working on, Phil Tippett, a lot of people don't know him by name, but I know our geek circle does, especially Aaron here. He worked on everything from Star Wars to Jurassic Park to Starship Troopers. Like, he's been a stop animator and one of the people that basically helped make CGI the way it looks now. Like, one of the reasons why the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park will always look better in the first movie than any of the others is because of the technology that Phil Tippett helped create for that movie. And so Phil Tippett is a hero of mine. And he made this movie. I think he's gotten very not nihilistic, but I don't think he has a lot of hope for the future for the human race. After watching that, God, it first starts out with a very apocalyptic type. Well, it's not apocalyptic. It's Old Testament, Leviticus, right? It's Old Testament, about the destruction of man. And Leviticus, was it 27 through 36, which is a very, you know, pissed off guy blowing up things, you know, which is, God. But it starts, it's not, giving you the plot of this movie is irrelevant because it's really not about the plot.
The what?
The plot. What plot?
The
yeah.
What?
You know, but
all right, that's
fair. There's a character that's called the Assassin, and we follow him initially into basically it's like almost a 7 or 8 seal layers of hell. Each area is more terrible than the next, and each one's more depraved. And he's on a futile mission that has been repeated over and over again by others, and he will fail in his mission. And basically, with his failure, the beginning of the world starts over again, and it all goes back to war over and over again. And the human race will forever be an endless loop of war and death. Very, very uplifting, good, feel-good movie of the year. But that's irrelevant in the sense that it's absolutely one of the most beautiful spectacles I have seen in a long time. Like, it is absolutely amazing. If you can see this on the big screen, I will... absolutely do it. I'm so glad. It is on Shudder, so it is accessible for people that don't want to go to the theater. But if you do it, turn off the lights. Turn up the TV as bright as possible because it's a very dark film, you know, physically dark, with moments mm-hmm. of splash of color, which is kind of amazing. And give your full attention to it because it's not a film to put in the background, not at least at initial watch. It might be a film that I put in the background for many years to come as an, you know, as I do stuff. But there's moments like you just want to pause. The one thing you can do with Shudder is you can pause it and look at things because there's throwouts to so much pop culture. Like Robbie the Robot pops up, Ray Harryhausen's Mockettes pop up, all this stuff. Like it's a sensory overload movie, but it's also very, very bleak. you know, but I don't even know what more to say about it, Nathan, other than it's going to make my top 10 this year, absolutely. Right now, I would say it's probably my favorite film of the year.
This movie straight up blew my mind. Like, you know those movies, and it doesn't happen very often, where you leave and you're almost in a stupor. Your mind is just still unpacking what you've just seen. And, you know, trying to wrap your head around the symbolism behind any of it, and you're driving home like, oh, that character represented God, and that character represented entropy, and this is what was going on here. And you're almost trying to catch up with the amount of imagery and symbolism packed into this film. This is one of those kind of films. I was just going to say, it almost seems almost like a Rorschach test, like one of those movies where... Watching this movie, whatever you think it's about, it is 100% about. Which I think it's interesting that they left enough room to where they had a clear message, but left enough open room for you to imprint your own message on it.
At the credits, though, on a completely, like, awesome, funny note, I always forget that Phil Tippett is a local guy. Matter of fact, I almost dated one of his assistants in the 90s. he used to be a regular at my store. I had a New Age shop in Berkeley. In Albany, but on the edge of Berkley. And with my parents. And the credits roll, and I start recognizing names in the credits, including Eric Layton, who was the animator supervisor on Nightmare Before Christmas and a friend of the family. He was on the credits. And then even cooler, my favorite Mexican restaurant in Berkeley, Juan's, was given a special thanks. And I'm like, Juan! I just yelled it so loud in the theater. You know, that's the one that when you're trying to hit on the girl and your first or second date, you always take them to Juan's. You know, it's not a fancy place, but the food is fucking solid and the margaritas are even better. So that was awesome. So Mad God is a huge recommend on our end. Let's see. Anything else we got to talk about? So much. But so definitely Bob's Burgers is a recommend as well, but I would say that it's not on the mind-blowing level that Mad God was, but to see them in the same week was kind of amazing, actually.
No, definitely the two ends of the animation spectrum.
No doubt.
I know that there's two things that Raven and I wanted to talk about for sure. And then we'll get back to you in a moment, Nathan. We'll talk about the Highlander next. First of all, I know that Raven wanted to talk about the Weird Al Yankovic trailer that dropped, and the movie's about to drop very soon. There was a teaser trailer, but now there's a full trailer out.
Yeah. Let me just say some words, and I think we'll be in the same spot mentally. First of all, Roku original. Already confused. That's okay. Roku original. We've got Weird Al biopic. That's also already really weird in its own right. And then we have Daniel Radcliffe, Weird Al. The trailer plays almost like an SNL satire commercial. At first, is this an actual movie, or is this a Funny or Die sketch?
Yeah.
I'm still not sure which one it is, you know, but I'm all in. I'm Al in, if you will. I can't stop watching that trailer. I can't stop sending it to people and going, what the hell is happening here? Also, I need to watch this right now. I don't know if it's going to be a disaster or painful or painfully funny, and it doesn't really matter. I'm so intrigued. So, yeah, check out the trailer if you haven't watched it yet. It's an anomaly.
And the other thing I wanted to talk about, and Raven had some very strong opinions about this, but it also plays into John Waters was announced yesterday that he's getting a star on the Hollywood Boulevard.
Walk of Fame. And
I'm actually elated that they've paid the money to put his star there. But Raven has some very strong opinions about Hollywood Boulevard. And I told her she could mention it.
Oh, I can have it like this will just be a quickie bitch. because this is so like hypocritical, because one of my favorite things to do is just wander around aimlessly and look at all the names on the stars and go, wow, that's really cool. Look, why is Jimmy Stewart next to like B. Arthur? I don't know. It's crazy. So that being said, the dream was kind of stripped from me, because growing up wanting to get into acting professionally, that was part of the package deal of my dream. One day I'll have my name on the Walk of Fame, right? And there is a $50,000 application fee to apply for the star that goes to the City of Hollywood. If you get denied, you don't get your money back. This is good in some ways. For example, Kim Kardashian has been turned down 5 times, and I think that's hilarious. On the other hand, you end up with people who can apply multiple times because they can afford it, and as long as they can prove longevity in whatever of the 5 categories there are, you know, there's like TV, radio, movies, et cetera, directing, you're going to get your star. And Donald Trump has 3 stars. When you see someone has pissed on his star or demolished it with a sledgehammer, that's 1 of 3. You know who else has a star? Godzilla. And Godzilla has a star.
Godzilla earns one.
Oh, Godzilla deserves every bit of that star.
I have no problem with a kaiju star. I mean, it's Godzilla.
I'm okay with it, but the point is, Godzilla did not fill out his application. This was done by Godzilla fan club did it.
The Mothra twins did that.
Mothra.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. All right. You know, I agree with
they filled it out for
with 99% of your drive-by bitch, but let me say First off, I literally yesterday walked by Vincent Price on my way to the Funko Superstore.
Oh,
and
cool.
That made my day. And in this one particular case, normally you're 100% right. It's usually a bunch of PR flacks getting someone a star because they got a movie coming out and they want the publicity for it. I agree with you. However, in this one case, Outfest, which is a California nonprofit that provides support to LGBTQIA artists, paid the fee. So I'm down with that part. And
that
Star Wars.
I wish what the city of Hollywood would do would take even 1% of that application fee and help the over 30,000 homeless people get into a better situation. That would be great. So we've got a ways to go, but I do appreciate the historical benefit of it, and I love John Waters more than life itself. Zap.
Nice.
Now, I did want to go back to Atlanta because Atlanta has a, you know, we're talking about, you know, landmarks and things like that. Atlanta has an area called, I guess it's called the Ponce area. Is that what it's called, Nathan, with the plaza and all that there, right?
Yeah, it's over right off Ponce and Little Five Points in the Highlands area,
Is, you know, that's the where the plaza is. Little Five Points is where all the little clubs used to be or are. And it used to be kind of this cultural little area. When I was before my time, it still is, but not quite to the extent it was.
But still is where a lot of cool stuff is.
So on top of the plaza, I went to two other establishments in that area. One is the Fellini Pizza. First of all, it's named after Fellini, which is, you know, Fellini. So once again, you got a movie connection there. But the pizza's fucking killer. So shout out to Fellini's. We went there a couple of times this last week. But one of the
I showed you Fellini's, and we ended up going there 3 times in a week.
Yeah, so, you know, a good slice of pizza.
It's that good.
It's pretty solid. There's been a move to get all that is a lot of the, like, local culture is disappearing. All the little clubs are being turned into sports bars or fine dining establishments because they put this hike, usually a rail to trails project will bring, like, the local flavor to the masses, right? Because people that don't have cars use the bikes and they can get to these places, but it's having the opposite effect in Atlanta. They're actually tearing down the clubs and putting in these, like, generic, like, high-end mixed-use units.
Mixed-use development.
Yeah, and fine dining establishments. And one fell this week that everyone was pretty devastated about. It's called the Highlander. It was the punk club that was in this area, and it closed its doors suddenly this week. So when everyone found out it was closing, all of us got in our cars, and it was packed. We went down there, and we all had drinks, and I'm going to let Nathan talk about it because this was one of his haunts growing up. And once again, rest in peace to another killer punk club. So.
Man, it was more than a punk club. It was definitely a punk club. I saw some killer punk shows there over the years, but it was also a metal club. It was also like a rockabilly club. It's been all these kinds of different kind of rock all play there, and it's just a kind of a catch-all venue. But it was a dive bar that randomly made the best plate of mussels in Atlanta and has been featured on Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives twice. So it was a cool-ass place where I've been seeing some cool shows since, God, I probably went there for the first time in, like, 97, 98, something like that, and been seeing shows since then. And, yeah, the development they were in kind of got priced out, and someone else came in and bought it, and they said Monday, hey, this is our last night, we're closing. So that sucked, but it was cool because, you know, everybody was like, well, I got to go up to the Highlander and have a last drink, whatever. And the place was packed. It was cool. They did more business Monday night than they had in the 6 months previous. But And if you got, if you have a drink, put it up. Here's to a club that gave Atlanta a lot of good times and a lot of good memories for a lot of good shows, a lot of strongly poured drinks, and a lot of after hours being open when nowhere else in town was. Here's to the Highlander.
Here, here. I got a drink too. As this could be my one and only time going to this place, it reminded me of CBGB's quite a bit, actually. Not in its layout, but in its style, like the small stage with the adjacent bar where they sold the local art to the masses. So all that was there. And CBGB's used to do the exact same thing. And I coincidentally was at CBGB's the weekend it was announced it was closing. So I have this like really bad habit of going one time to the famous punk club and seeing it go away. So I hope it's not my fault. But here's to the Highlander.
But here's what I'm thinking. At a club called the Highlander, that means if it closes, some other club in Atlanta has experienced the quickening. Like all that punk and metal energy is going to have to find a new host at some club in Atlanta, or a new one might pop up. So I'm just holding on to that. Someone's going to get the quickening, and we're going to get another great venue pop up.
And to lighten the mood, I actually introduced Nathan to a punk pop kids band that out of D.C. called Eyeball Skeleton.
Eyeball Skeleton.
And he's been singing Spooky Mummy Case ever since.
Oh, my God. That song is so insidious. It has, like, some kind of hidden occult, like, curse in the lyrics that just make it stick in your head and never leave, and you're cursed forever with it. But like, a couple of their songs, straight up unlistenable. And then they hit Redfish and Spooky Mummy Case, and they're both solid jams. And after that, the whole album's like some 60s garage rock stuff sung by an 8-year-old.
Six and eight.
it's dope.
The band is consisting of brothers, six and eight, and this was in 2005 when this band was founded, so they're much older now. But they were six and eight when they started, and then their father was their music director. And you can get this. I found that most of their songs on Amazon Prime, with the exception of Lost Cat, which is one of my favorite songs by them. It's based on the famous poster of this cat that someone was looking for. And it's not spelled Lost. It's spelled L-O-S-S. Lost Cat. And here it goes back to Atlanta. It turns out it's a print that they sent from Atlanta. I had no idea. I always thought it was a local thing in D.C., but it's not. So all roads lead to Lost Cat. So
I'm putting out a challenge to any of the listeners out there, any of my fellow sexy witches, whatever. Once we are done here, Google Eyeball Skeleton Spooky Mummy Case. Listen to it one time and shut it off. Don't listen to it again. And I guarantee you within 48 hours, you're going to catch yourself just on a random moment going, Spooky Mummy Case, Spooky Mummy Case, and realize that you've got the curse too. Listen to it once. It will happen within 48
Challenge
hours.
Accepted.
I promise you. It is such an insidious brain worm, man.
And if people don't want to Google it, I am actually going to play it at the end of the show tonight. I have it queued up. So we have a couple minutes before our guest, Will Keenan, calls in. So do we have any last thoughts on things and anything before they call in?
I have one brief one.
Okay, go ahead.
I don't remember if you mentioned it or not, but I wanted to get it out that Mad God was Phil Tibbetts 30 years in the making, which I just blows my mind. He did it in between various things, and wow, just insane.
It shows.
And then I want that. Yeah, seriously.
It shows some shots in that that are so detailed that they had to take forever for like single shots in that.
Yeah, because, you know, all by hand, and, you know, he had to train the people who were working on it, and just, it blows my mind. And the other thing I wanted to ask, is anyone watching Star Trek Strange New Worlds or Ms. Marvel?
yet.
I
haven't watched The Boys yet either. So I was going to hold off for another episode. So another episode, I should be caught up.
Right on.
We wanted to finish up Obi-Wan before we started another show. So now that Obi-Wan's over, I'm going to binge dive The Boys and catch up with that. And
yes.
So.
Did you see Diabolical yet?
No,
the animated series.
No.
I've watched 4 episodes. I recommend.
Was it on?
It's on Amazon. It's in the same world of The Boys. And in fact, Captain Lorca from Discovery and Malfoy's dad, I'm going to blank on his name. He does a really, really good Billy Butcher impression. But every single episode of this animated series, and they're all very short, has a different animated style. The first one just is pure Carl Stalling and Chuck Jones. And it's genius, and they're all fun and severely twisted, and some great people working on them. Justin from Rick and Morty does one, and they're all brilliant, and none of them are the same. So it's a little animated boys series that features the world of The Boys.
Excellent. And
on Amazon Prime.
Speaking of boys, let me introduce our guest tonight. People will know him as a young man in the Troma movies, including Terra Firma and his first starring role in Romeo and Juliet, arguably one of the best Troma films out there. But he has a very eclectic career. Not just that, he was also the star of Kathy Love of Johnny X, and he is a digital innovator, an actor, producer, editor, and even a spiritual leader in New Jersey. Please welcome to the show and give a great sexy witch hello to actor and Renaissance man, Will Keenan. Thank you for being on the Sexy Witches, sir.
Woo-hoo. Hi. Can you hear me?
Hello. Yes, you sound great. How you doing?
Okay. Yeah, good. I love that introduction. You may have known him as a young man, and now I'm what? I'm an old man?
We're the same age, so, you know, it's not the years, it's the mileage.
No.
So, you know.
You're old. No, I'm just kidding. No.
Yeah, I am old. I am old.
Plenty of years, plenty of mileage. How are you guys doing tonight?
Great. Thank you for coming on the show. We were just geeking out on some Star Wars and a few other things tonight, but we're going to bring it back
to old school
indie cinema because we've been covering independent cinema. It's always one of our main topics, but this year we've been deep diving it. We even had Dean Behar on the show, which I know you have a minor connection with Cannibal, the musical we also had Jeremiah Kipp on the show, which you give a shout out to. I just watched your short, Tromeo Found 25 years later, and he was in the special thanks. So, you know, it all roads lead back to indie cinema. And, for the sexy witches that may not, or our listeners that may not know much about you by name, but they certainly know you by face, why don't you give a quick thumbnail of your career and then we'll deep dive some of your stuff. And once again, thank you for coming on the show.
Sure. Oh, boy. I haven't done this in a little while. Career. I got into NYU Early Decision and by auditioning for Tisch School of the Arts. And they gave me a pile of money and gave me an early decision. I was like, all right, I guess I'll take this thing seriously. And I was there, and it was very expensive. We're going back to the, I guess, early 90s. And I decided to get my money's worth and double majored and double minored. So it was theater and psychology and philosophy and dance. And they put me in the really weird, theater program called the Experimental Theater Wing. And I really just fell in love with performance art, dance, and avant-garde theater. And I was happy. I knew it would never make any money, but I was happy. And then the week before graduation, my friends and I were all sitting around my apartment on St. Mark's Place in New York City, and someone was looking through backstage. We're all talking about what we're going to do after graduation, and one of them was like, "Oh my God, Troma's casting!" And I was like, "What's Troma?" And they were like, "What do you mean? You don't know Toxic Avengers, Surf Nazis Must Die, Class of Nukem High, da da da, going on and on." And I was like, "I have no idea what you're talking about." I didn't watch a lot of movies when I was a kid. I was more of a going outside and climbing trees and stuff. But they said it's Romeo and Juliet, and it was like there's actual Shakespeare in it. And I had just finished up a whole semester of Shakespeare and fell in love with that kind of acting. It's kind of like full-bodied acting. And so we all went down and auditioned. And then they called me back, and then I was working with Jane, and they were videotaping all the auditions. And I guess Lloyd would watch them at home with his wife, Patty Pie. And from what I heard, she's the one who really cast me. She's the one who said, "You got to go with this guy." And I had no idea what I was getting into. I read that script and I was like, "Oh my God!" But there was actual Shakespeare in it. And I said to myself, you know, who knows if I ever get another chance to do Shakespeare on film? So I think they paid me $300 for 2 months' work. And it was a real learning experience. I remember when I first saw the movie at the Cannes Film Market, and I think it was 96 or something. I don't even remember when, but I was aghast at what I looked like on film because I was a stage actor, and I was essentially overacting. But I guess it worked for Troma because, you know, I look like a Troma monster sometimes, the facial expressions I make, and that's something that. You know, and I did like 45 movies after that, but it's something I don't know if I ever really cracked that nut because, you know, the film, it's the all-seeing eye. It sees everything. On stage, you know, you have to emote to the, you know, back of the room, however big the room is. You know, TV is more close-ups, and YouTube, like a Troma character or monster on YouTube, like broad, you know, actions and gestures and stuff on a super tiny screen. So I don't know if I ever totally cracked that nut, but and then that was the kind of the beginning of it because I didn't know that Troma was an established independent, like, you know, film institution pretty much even back then, and then, you know, other offers to play really weird, sick and twisted characters came about. I think my second movie was credited as the first fully digital feature film, and it was by a company back then called Good Machine. Which was, you know, Good Machine, Miramax, there were Fine Line. There were a few companies back then that were just, you know, at the top of their game with indie cinema around the world. Good Machine was one of them, and you know, he's pretty famous, and he makes great movies. Producer Anthony Bregman, Eternal Sunshine, and lots of movies every year now. That was his first producing gig. And he picked this really weird script called Love God. It's about a kind of schizophrenic with compulsive reading syndrome who's being followed by ancient fertility figures. And there was over 3,000 cuts in the movie and really loud punk rock music through it. And gets credit for being the first fully digital feature film because Sony had lent Good Machine, a very reputable indie film company at the time, and they lent them a digital beta camera just to test it out. And rather than just test it out, Anthony, who was another famous producer, Ted Hope's assistant at the time, he said, you know, "I'll make a whole movie with it, and I want to do this script." Very, very weird movie. And then there was a kind of a resurgence of indie film in New York during those years. There had been a boycott or something with the unions for a while, so there wasn't much except for guerrilla filmmaking going on. But then in the mid-late 90s, you know, indie cinema just, you know, I mean, there was film festivals popping up like, you know, every other week. And I just kind of racked them up, did all these movies, and I caught the bug early on. I think it was after my second movie as a lead, Love God, that I made my first short film called Hoof Boy, a mockumental melodrama about a young man's feet and the women who won't touch them. And then, you know, we produced more movies. I did one, I think the last movie I made in New York City, because I started producing and co-directing and co-writing and starring in all my movies. Operation Midnight Climax, OMC, was one. It was my big stunt movie. I think there's a stunt in every scene, some kind of conspiracy theory in every scene. And then, you know, 9/11 happened, and I started to, like, really think about what I wanted to do with my life. I was threatening to go to, you know, the Himalayas and just become a monk. And then I fell with someone who was in one of the Troma movies with me. So I did two Troma movies, Tromeo and Juliet, where I played Tromeo. And then I think it was like a year and a half, 2 years later, we shot Terror Firmer, which is kind of, you know, what the heck would you call Terror Firmer?
I just watched it for the first time in my life today, prepping for this interview.
First of all, pretty much playing himself, except he's not blind.
It's kind of meta, but it's still completely a Troma movie with all the gore and gross out you want. Probably their last, I would say, good film. You know, like high end. You know, because it definitely was shot. Yeah. You could tell in a pre 9/11 world. Maybe the last innocent.
So Lloyd,
film.
I mean, it was very, you know, shooting a Troma movie is like going to war, right? So after Tromeo, and I got to travel, you know, around the world, go to Cannes, all that kind of stuff, and you know, people knew me as Tromeo, but you know. Having, you know, that being my first movie, starting my film career like that, it was almost like a porn career. It opened up some doors, but it slammed other ones shut. So I really had to work hard in that era to, you know, do other kinds of independent films to be almost taken seriously. And then Lloyd asked me to be the lead in Terror Firmer, and I read the script, and he wanted me to play the character Trent Haga plays, the Jerry character. And I said, no, I want to play the other character, and I'd like it to be rewritten as a hermaphrodite. And Lloyd was like, what are you talking about? You're crazy. And I told him I wanted to cast Trent Haga as Jerry. He's like, what? No, you're crazy. He looks like a Steve Buscemi on heroin. But I got my way. I told him I didn't want to do the movie. And I told him I also wanted to be a producer on the movie and kind of do what James Gunn did, you know, on Tromeo, and like Trent did on Citizen Toxie, because I really wanted to, you know, learn as much about filmmaking as I could. So, you know, the script was always being tinkered with. You know, I staged all the rehearsals and was a real producer on the movie, and I'm glad I did it. And, you know, to play the cinema's first hermaphrodite serial killer was pretty cool. But, you know, I think it was ahead of its time in a way, because even that ending scene, that kind of with the South Park boys, Trey and Matt, where they're hermaphrodites and they don't know which bathroom to use and stuff. So that was like 20 years ahead of its time as far as like gender identity and bathrooms and so forth. And feeding Ron Jeremy, feeding Ron Jeremy.
Jeremy pops up, and Joe Lynch did a couple of behind the scenes. He was actually below the line on that. That surprised me to see his name pop up like at three different jobs. Like, I guess everyone in Troma wears many hats. This is kind of how it works on Troma.
That is true, especially if you're like, I think Joe started out as a production assistant, and he's in the movie. He's the character that has clothespins all over his face. But yeah, Joe's he was a super smart guy, super nice guy, really hard worker. And that's the thing. I mean, Troma, it's like a revolving door. A lot of people, you know, they take their time shooting. You know, it's like a 2-month, 3-month thing sometimes. And people are getting fired all the time. People are walking off all the time. Not everyone can handle being on a Troma movie. I was lucky in Tromeo because I was the lead actor. So both Jane and I, who played Juliet, Jane Jensen, we were the only ones. Cause, I mean, there's a behind-the-scenes documentary of Terror Firmer called, was it called? Oh, yeah. Farts of Darkness, and it's really behind the scenes of a Troma movie. People watch that. Even Troma fans watched it, and they're like, "Oh, come on, that can't be true. It can't be like that." Like, no, oh, it is like that. But as a lead, we were the only ones not yelled at by Lloyd, because he's a madman on set. And the only reason the leads aren't yelled at is because, I think he says this in his book or something, that is because if we walk off, you know, if we get pissed off because he's a madman and yells, you know, and screams. And I mean, I've seen him make people cry. I mean, I heard he told someone that that's the first thing he wants to do when he gets on set is make someone cry, you know, like a poor PA, you know, PA who traveled from Kansas and is sleeping on the floor eating, you know, cheese sandwiches, not getting paid just to, you know, work on a trauma movie. He'll make that person cry right when he gets out of his car. Because he said it sends, something around the set that everyone has to be on their toes or something. I never totally agreed with that. But,
The
reason he doesn't yell at the
lead. At all.
What's that?
I say that doesn't sound like your style at all.
No. And in fact, to kind of counteract my experiences on those trauma movies and some of the other, you know, because once I was Tromeo and then played the Casey Kaufman in Terra Firma, I was getting lots of offers, you know, leads, but they were really sick and twisted characters. And it was never, you know, wasn't really my cup of tea, but I guess I was good at it. But I would, after, you know, all day shooting, and getting done at midnight, I would go to a small cafe in the East Village, like, you know, like where a poetry slam was happening or open mic night or something, and I would do, like, spiritual rap poetry. But anyway, the reason Lloyd doesn't yell at his leads is because if they walk off, he has to reshoot with any other character, even a supporting character. He says, "We'll just put a watermelon in its place." He doesn't care. He just doesn't want to have to buy more film, you know. So that came out we shot that in the summer of '99. It came out 2000, 2001, and then 9/11 hit, and it was really kind of like, you know, what am I doing with my life? And I wanted to become a monk, but I fell in love. Someone who was in I was the casting director of Terra Firma as well. Someone who was in Terra Firma, who I cast, who I was kind of secretly in love with. 9/11, we were kind of like a 9/11 relationship. After it happened, she lived in the East Village. I lived in Williamsburg, and it happened. And, you know, I just started walking across the bridge, and who do I see walking across the bridge from Manhattan was her. And we fell in love.
Aww.
And it was very sweet. And we were together 15 years. And we moved to Los Angeles in 2003. And in a way, I got the best of both worlds because I really did just want to go off and become a monk. But we moved to Los Angeles and lived in technically an ashram, a spiritual hermitage, for 7 years. And that was amazing because I was still in the industry and I was doing some acting out there. I think one of the first gigs I got out there was playing the fake white Michael Jackson on NBC's Law and Order SVU. I was producing as well. So I would be, you know, and the ashram, the spiritual hermitage, was in East Hollywood. So during the day, I'd be out, like, you know, with all the Hollywood types, and I'd be able to come back to the ashram, and it took up pretty much a whole city block, and it's, you know, running water and benches to meditate and, you know, a beautiful environment, and that kind of kept my sanity back then. But in 2006, I guess, when the economy took the downturn, because I was producing independent films, and we were getting, you know, I was really good at raising money, like, you know, whether it's a $200,000 indie movie or $2 million or $4 million one, and I was mostly raising money from, you know, rich finance guys, like hedge fund guys, who really didn't care if they made their money back. They just wanted to come to the parties and meet actresses. But all that kind of, you know, and even foreign pre-sales, everything dried up when the economy kind of crashed in 2006, 2007. And the only, you know, especially independent film industry in the whole world that wasn't affected by it was in India, like Bollywood and Tollywood, Southern Indian films. So I just went on an exploratory trip. I think it was like 2006, 2007. To India, and because I was a Westerner who had some legitimate credits to the name, they kind of rolled out the red carpet for me. And for about a period of 4 years, I was flying to India, you know, every year on and off. My first trip there was like 2 weeks. My last trip there was 11 months. I was working with some of the biggest stars there as a producer, Shah Rukh Khan, Malika Shervat, you know, Shweta Pandit, Shruti Hassan. I don't know if you know any of these, but and that was a whole other world. But it was very, it was like working on a trauma movie in a way, because they shoot films very, very differently. And then my last trip there was 11 months. Like I said, my wife, the girl I'm talking about, became my wife. She called me, and she was doing really well in Los Angeles. She became Getty Images' most senior contributing photographer. She said, "Look, I know you're doing well out there," and I was. I mean, they had me on the cover of the Bombay Times, which is like the New York Post of all of India, as a hot young Hollywood producer. She said, "But if you don't come back, I think we're going to have a problem in our marriage." I was living large. I had a driver, a cook, a gardener, a domestic staff.
Wow.
And within 3 days, I was back in L.A. And then I said, okay, what now? And I since 2006, pretty much, when YouTube came out, I've always wanted to so this is like 2011, for 4 or 5 years, I always wanted to transition from, you know, traditional filmmaking to digital. And by then, I could see what was happening on YouTube. You know, I could see YouTube stars being, you know, essentially building themselves. And I just thought, you know, especially in the spirit of indie cinema, where we did a lot of guerrilla filmmaking without permits and kind of do it yourself. And it was like, you still needed a bunch of people. It takes a village to make a movie. Even takes a miracle to finish it. But with YouTube and all the kind of prosumer, you know, cameras and editing equipment, I was really, really interested in it. But so I got back, and for 3 weeks, I just put myself in a boot camp, and I studied everything I could. We had this big dining room table, and it was just filled with stacks of printouts with highlights and notations. And at the end of it, I was kind of like, ha-ha, I know everything about digital. And now I didn't, but I think that confidence level kind of sent something out into the universe, because like hours later, I get a call from the wife of an old friend, Liza Lynn. Michael Lynn, he was one of the producers of East True Hollywood Story, and we had done like a TV pilot together. She called me, and she's like, I hear you're back in town. You know, I'm working at this, she's HR, human resources, at it was called Multi-Channel Networks at the time, called Maker Studios. And I was like, oh, I know Maker, because I had just read about them. And then she got me in an interview with some of the founders, and they hired me immediately. And so since this was like a career transition, from day one, I just wanted to make myself indispensable to every department. So, and then this was, you know, kind of the rise of multi-channel networks on YouTube and YouTube stars. So it was right place, right time. And I guess I did the right job and moved up the ladder pretty quickly. And then because we did so well, and the company Maker Studios was sold to Disney for almost $1 billion, my name was out there, and then I was asked to become president of Endemol's North American Digital Division. Endemol being, I think still, Endemol Shine now, is the world's largest television production company. And that was cool. Oh. And I did that for two years, and then I was starting to get burned out because I was working so much, and it kind of ended our marriage. She was working too much. I was working too much. We'd see each other maybe. We lived together, slept in the same bed, but we may see one another once a week. Because whenever I got home, she was asleep. Whenever I woke up, she was gone, you know, out working. So we kind of grew apart that way. And, now I'm lost. No, I'm just kidding. So I started to get burned out, and then I was going to take a sabbatical. So now we're at like a 2015-16, like a true sabbatical, 6 months off the grid. I just wanted to stand on my head at some place, you know, where I couldn't access any digital, any analog, nothing. I just wanted to meditate and, have someone drop off vegetables and fruit once a week and do a solitary kind of thing for 6 months. But because of my career and great friends all around the world, some of them doing very well, I was getting these amazing offers to do it in India, to do it in Greece at my friend's palace, or to do it in Rome, da, da, da. And then this voice in my head say, if you do this, by the time you come back, your mother's not going to be alive. So I called my mom, who lives in a small town in South New Jersey, And I said, hey, Ma, do you mind if I come back to do my 6-month sabbatical in my old room when I was like 16 years old? And she said, sure, Billy. And and I thought I had 6 months with her because I knew she was sick. Some of my family members who lived around here, they're like, oh, you're being dramatic, you actor. But I just kind of knew. You know, she was battling cancer after she had passed, going through all her paperwork for like 9 years, and she didn't tell anybody. She was a nurse, an OBGYN, a baby nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to call her the Mother Teresa of nursing at Cooper Hospital in Camden, New Jersey. Yeah, and I thought I had 6 months with her. Turned out to be 6 days. My sisters say that pretty much waited for me to come home. And then when that happened, I was mourning. And instead of like cutting my sabbatical short or just taking off and standing on my head in India, I reconnected with a lot of family and friends in South Jersey. And I lived in her condo for a few months, 3 or 4 months, and mourned. And I was visiting friends on the Jersey Shore, the South Jersey Shore, not what you hear, you know, not the MTV show. It's called the Jersey Cape, Cape May, Wildwood, Ocean City, Seattle City. And I got tired of taking the Atlantic City Expressway and the Garden State Parkway, and I started taking the back roads. And this would be, I think, October, November of 2016. I saw this historic old church for sale with this cemetery around it where people born in the 1700s, a lot of the famous founding families of Cape May County are buried here, built this church. And I just decided to do there was a number out front for the real estate agent. I just wanted to go inside and check it out. And I called them. I was like, they call me back. You know, maybe I'll go see it before I go back north. I got the call back in 10 minutes. You like to see the church? Supposedly it had been on the market for a while. So I saw it, and I guess the spirit hit me. And I made an offer, and they accepted it, like an all-cash offer. And I took over this. I kind of saved this historic church, and I started a foundation and a church, and I named it after my mother. Her name was Barbara. I call it St. Babs. It's kind of like a church of all religions. You know, even atheists come to some of our meditation services. And I've been here for, I guess 5 years now. And something just came out in the Philadelphia Inquirer because we just acquired an 18-acre estate as our retreat center. And it's been, I got to tell you, it's the most challenging gig I've ever had because I don't have a staff of 40, like my last few jobs. I'm in a very different place, and I'm just, my gig now is just trying to live a life of service. So we've provided emergency shelter to like 150 people. I've given out pretty much hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash and computer equipment, music equipment, clothing, food, and so forth to families in need. And we have, like, guest pastors, preachers, or just, had a Sufi do a session here, a rabbi, a female Catholic priest. And it's kind of like an open-door policy, church of all religions type of place. And but it's the most challenging gig I've ever had, but the most fulfilling, I would say. And here
first
we are.
Of all,
I've kept my foot in the industry. Like, I'm executive producer of a documentary called The Last Sermon, one of Jack Baxter's, kind of a famous controversial documentary filmmaker. And I consult on the side. And I think I got a few left in me, and people have been asking me, I still, even from the trauma days, I still get a few offers a year from like people who like that kind of movie and they're making their own and they want me to be in it. But, I did Shakespeare at the Philadelphia Fringe Festival last year and they asked me to do it again. So doing it here and there, and the biggest thing, you ready? I have a daughter. I have a child.
Yay.
10 months and like 3 days old. Her name is Alan Meta Keenan.
Oh.
And I can't even put it in words because I call her Super Miracle Baby because I hope this doesn't gross you out. When I was 16 years old, I had an emergency operation down there on my nether regions. It's something called testicular torsion. They told me at the time it happened to 2% of growing American boys, and it's the second worst pain to labor. right there in one of your testicles. And it's just a weird thing. So that happened to me, and, you know, thankfully they were able to save my testicles, but they said you'll never be able to have children. And let's just say I've had a long and fulfilling romantic life, and no one ever came a knocking. I live a public enough life, and I've been rich at points where I feel like if I had a kid out there, they would have come a knocking by now. So, So I was in love again, for true love, I guess, you know, for the second time. And she had asked me, you know, about having kids. And I was like, well, look, here's my deal. But let's have fun trying. But she really convinced me, because I just never thought I could. She convinced me to try. So in our church, where we live in the back, it's like where we were living in the back, it's like a parsonage. And for like 6 months, I just went out into the sanctuary and lovingly demanded from God to make this possible. And then I think it was like a day or two before Christmas Eve in 2019, I was working outside. And she comes out, and she's, like, crying. She's like, Will, Will. And I'm like, whoa, 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 who do I need to kill? What's going on? She beat pink pregnancy test. I forget what it's called. She's like, I'm pregnant. And I'm like, oh, God, honey, no, no, no. Oh, don't get your hopes up, please, baby. And she's like, no, I can feel it. I'm pregnant. And then I went out and bought two of the expensive ones, the $50 digital ones that blank, pregnant. And over a 8-hour period, it was like three in a row. It said she was pregnant. I was like, holy shit, this is happening. And it's the greatest joy. I've never known a love like this. You know, I've always tried to, you know, be collaborative, help people. I've helped a lot of people in their careers. I've helped people through St. Babs, but, it's still unexplainable to me that, there's something, you know, more important than anything in the whole world. And that's this little girl and being her dad.
Well, congratulations on the baby. That's amazing.
Yeah, thank
you.
I
also want to thank you for doing what you're doing in Cape May. I am a huge fan of Cape May. I used to go there all the time.
Are you?
I actually was there for Thanksgiving this year. I actually took Nathan, our co-host, to Maurice here to do Dante's Dungeon
there.
Because we're both Dark Ride enthusiasts, and I wanted to make sure he saw Maurice Pier because it's, you know, as vintage as you get. Wildwood at night is gorgeous, of course. So thank you for preserving, because not only as you turned it into a meditation center, but you saved it for that 18 acres from a housing development, which is we don't need more of those things. So not down there.
True. And it's right there in you're welcome. Yeah, it's right there in Rio Grande. They say it's the last property of its kind down there, right at the gateway to Cape May and Wildwood. And not a lot of people even knew about it because the same family's had it for like 75 years. And it was just, you know, especially with, you know, having had a child, and I thought, you know, we saved a church, St. Babs saved an historic church, but surrounded by death, right? There's this historic cemetery that, you know, it's a 2-acre property and it's mostly old dead people. And then you know, having a baby, it's like this new life. And then kind of, you know, saving this natural oasis, the last of its kind in that area, where it's teeming with life. I mean, I don't think I knew this when I was a kid, because we used to vacation on the Jersey Cape all the time. I had houses in Wildwood and Seattle City. But the Jersey Cape is one of the bird-watching capitals of the world. And
yes,
that,
it is.
You know, a state we call now Lake Safe Haven at St. Babs Grand Retreat, and Grand with an E, like Rio Grande. But that's one of the bird-watching capitals of the Jersey Cape, and it's the last American holly forest in Cape May County, and there's all these birds different kinds of birds that go there, and there's this famous eagle that has a nest there. It's really, really amazing.
I mean, it's not just birds, it's the raptor corridor. You are on the actual pathway the raptors migrate through. I know this because I used to go there every year for the bird migration. Yes, I absolutely do. I used to be a park ranger, so I used to go down to Cape May every October to do the raptor migration.
Did you go to Reed's Beach? Which is like a mile away from the church on Route 47. the Reeds Beach. It's on the bay side, right?
And it's, yeah, I have. I did you know, go to of, the bay side. I actually yeah, prefer the bay because, side.
And there's this, I think it's in May, early May, when one of the migrations is going on. There's like all these, you know, millions. It looks like millions of horseshoe crabs just kind of roll up
aww,
on the beach, and then
I
the,
love horseshoe
the birds come and just. The birds come and just pick at them for a few weeks or something like that. Next time.
Oh, no, I was going to say, please. Yeah, no, next time I will definitely let you know if I'm coming to town because I love Cape
absolutely,
May. I have friends that still live there.
I'm sure they know St. Babs.
I bet you they do. I'm going to actually talk to him about this tomorrow probably and say, hey, Shane, what's up? Cool. You know that this person
I'm glad you didn't talk to them before tonight because who knows what they would have said. You know, when I first got here, my first year here, I tried to do a Halloween event at this old church. And a lot of the locals, because it was news here, you know, the Philadelphia Inquirer did a story that I took over the church and Press of Atlantic City and stuff. And even though I'm from here, they still, you know, I hadn't been here for a while. I'm what they call like an outsider. They call them shoobies, which is people who used to, many years ago, come down to the Jersey Shore from Philly or somewhere else and spend the day and have their lunch in a shoebox. And all the locals down here almost hate the summer season because, you know, on the Jersey Cape during the summer season, which is pretty much, you know, from late April till, you know, early September, there's 2 million people coming back and forth. In the off seasons, there's less than 50,000 people here in this area. So it's a big deal. But I tried to do this Halloween thing, and people got really upset. And it was actually going to be classy. It was going to be classy because there's all these famous personages from this area in the cemetery. Civil War hero, the first female slave buried in a quote-unquote white cemetery. It's got a lot of history. So I was hiring actors to take people essentially on tour around the cemetery in character. And I think some of the locals, actually they told me months later, that they thought because of me and I'm an outsider and the Hollywood guy, they thought it was just going to be like a party and people desecrating graves and stuff. But they gave me a hard time. And it became news. It was like crazy. It was on NBC News. The controversy was in all the newspapers around here. It even made it to the UK Daily Mail, which is a big tabloid.
Yeah, that's
so,
a rag.
Although they beat me up for 6 months, my first 6 months here, kind of made the place world famous at the same time.
Which is funny awesome, because one of the most famous haunted tours in America is in Cape May. So you'd think they would embrace it. I'm not a huge fan of ghost tours, but it's the only one that I recommend is the one in Cape May.
Right.
So, you know,
I think it more had to do with the cemetery and people thought, because there's a few plots left, and actually there was a funeral here yesterday on Tuesday. So there are some newer interred personages. And, you know, I think they think it was disrespectful. And I wasn't, like, there was going to be no disrespect. Like, you know, my mother, I could never do anything that would be, in her words, untoward, you know, in her name. But they didn't know that when I first came to town, you know.
Right.
And, yeah. So, but it still confused me because I was like, wait a minute. Like, there's Halloween events in cemeteries, you know, all over the United States, all over the world. You know, every Halloween, why can't I do one here? And it became people still, you know, come up to me about it. And they're like, man, you know, sorry what they did to you back then. But we made it through. And kind of starting out here, you know, like that. What do they say? Like, you know, a prophet can never go back home type of thing. You know, so I think they were very suspect of me, I think, at first. But, you know, through the years, proving what we're about and what we're doing, now we're all friends. All the people who are really, you know, mad at me for trying to do a Halloween event in our cemetery, we're really good friends now.
Well, that's excellent. I do want to bring this back to your film career, because there's one film we haven't talked about yet, and it's the film that I got introduced to you from, and it also has its own place in history. I know that there's some issue with this movie, but it is the last black and white film shot on film, The Ghastly Love of Johnny X, and the reason why I know about it is it played at Blobfest in 2015. And so I was promoting, my friends run Blobfest, so I was promoting Blobfest on my brand new podcast, Archivist Bets on Sexy Witches here, and I had no idea about the movie. I was like, what is this movie on Sunday? Because they always do an indie film on Sunday. And Paul Linnell calls me up out of the blue and goes, you know, this is this movie. Can I be on your show and talk about it? And I'm like, yeah, you know, because I'm not going to turn down a guest, right? So it's an odd duck when it comes to a movie, because first of all, it's got the pedigree of being the last black and white movie, but it also is a 50s, 60s tribute movie musical classic
right.
horror film, and you star in this movie. I want to ask you, though, it's an odd question, though. The gang, the Ghastly Ones, is that a direct shout-out to the video Nasty movie, or is that just a coincidence?
You know, I have no idea. I mean, I think probably every line, every character, every, you know, costume piece is a reference to something, because that's kind of like Paul Bunnell, but from a certain era, those 50s sci-fi movies where the teenagers are 30 years old and they're from outer space and stuff. So I'm sure there's references throughout. He asked me to do it. I think this was like, I forget what year it was. Like 2004 or 5 or something. And I was producing, Indian American co-productions at the time. So I wasn't really acting. I was just producing, but he asked me to star in it. And I was like, look, man, I think you should cast all Indians, because that's where the money is. You know, I tried to talk myself out of casting it, of playing the lead. But I thought it was goofy enough, and I liked the script. And just like with, you know, my first movie, Tromeo, where I was like, will I ever get a chance to do Shakespeare on film again? This one was like, will I ever, you know, I had never sung on film, right? I'd never done a film musical. And it was going to be, I knew it was going to be the very last black and white widescreen anamorphic musical ever shot on film, because who the hell else would do that? and so we did it, and Paul didn't tell any of us. We shot for like 6 days and probably got in the can, you know, after editing 15 minutes of the movie, and then it shuts down because he ran out of money. We didn't know, like I didn't know, I was just the lead actor. I didn't get involved with any of the production or producing, so I didn't know anything. And that was very unfortunate. And then every year after that, he would call up every one of us in the cast and say, oh, I got the money. We're gonna finish the movie. We're like, great. And then it wouldn't happen. And then he would, the next year, and the next year, and the next year. And by the sixth year after we had shot, you know, for 1 week, he calls us all up and says the same thing. And all of us, yeah, sure. And all of a sudden the script shows up. And all of a sudden, the wardrobe people show up to, where I was living at the time in downtown L.A. And I'm like, wait a minute, is this really happening? And oddly enough, no one, at least, you know, even people who know that, you know, there's a six-year difference, from one scene to the next. No one could tell, because I guess we all looked, enough the same we did 6 years ago. But that was, it was, I'll say this. I'm not happy with my performance in that movie, first of all. I think the girl who played Bliss, I think she is incredible. I wish I would have done it a little more kind of balanced out, like kind of the tongue-in-cheek, because we know we're doing, you know, an homage to those movies, but make it a little bit of funny or something. But at the time, I was like, wait, this is the first role where I don't have to act like a crazy person, or, you know, I had to act like, you know, just be cool, man, just be cool. And I had never done that. So I don't like my performance in that movie, but Paul Bunnell, I've been on plenty of sets as an actor and as producer, As far as directors go, he was the most fun director I've ever worked with. And that was cool. And then, you know, it being historic because of, you know, the elements of the filmmaking, I was like, well, wait a minute. Now, in the, I guess the encyclopedia of world cinema history, I kind of have this cool spot. It's like a bookend. The star of the very first fully digital feature film and star of the very last black and white widescreen musical feature ever shot on film. And a bunch of weird stuff in between.
I'm going to throw this out to the sexy witches, and I'm going to start with Raven because I'm sure Raven has been chomping at the bit. She's the one that brought you on. So thank you, Raven, and thank you for responding, Raven, once again. Please, the floor is yours, my dear. If you have any questions, go ahead, and then we'll bring it back to the other gentlemen that are waiting. So.
Sure. Well, first I got to geek out for a sec and just say thank you so much for making my teenage years less terrible. I found Romeo and Juliet in high school when I was in a production of Romeo and Juliet as Juliet. And I was also the least popular person in my school. And the guy playing Romeo was the quarterback. So it was really intimidating. I was having a hard time with the language. It felt like everything was supposed to be a giant dick joke, but nobody else seemed to see it that way. And I felt like a lot of confirmation from Romeo and Juliet. Like, this is just a bunch of dick jokes strung together.
Totally.
And we can calm down about it a little bit. It really did help me loosen up. I got kind of addicted to trauma and theater. And, you know, because of that, I got hooked up with Toxic Avenger, the musical, and Lloyd Kaufman flew out and recorded our opening night before it went to the Broadway workshop. And so trauma has kind of given me a lot of opportunities randomly just by being a fan. So, thank you. It's just, like, high school sucked, and trauma helped.
I mean, trauma has definitely helped a lot of people get through their awkward high school years. And you're totally right. Like, you know, most of the people who work on trauma movies, except for, you know, some of the actors, a lot of the actors had never, like me, had never heard of trauma. But all the people who work on them, a lot of them are fans. But I'll tell you, you work on a trauma movie, no matter what department you're in, if you're able to, you know, stick it through it, you're an expert at that. They give a lot of people, I mean, Lloyd and Trauma have given lots of people their starts in their careers.
Yeah.
As, you know, I'm one of them, so we have him to thank for that.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And you're right. Awesome. Shakespeare is all about sex jokes. It's highbrow meets lowbrow. The writing is so good.
Mm-hmm.
The writing is so good. It's almost like, you know, those cartoons where, you know, the kids love it, but they don't understand it. And the adults love it too, because they understand what's really going on or what's really being said. Like, that's, you know, Shakespeare is all that. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
This has been great, guys.
So I have one question about making Romeo and Juliet, and how
I hope I remember.
Always think about how intimidating it had to have been doing, like, this freaking masturbating scene, and it's your first movie. I mean, you did stunt work too. What's scarier? Was it scarier to do stunts or a masturbation scene?
No. I was already a stuntman, and in my own movies, I used to get hit by cars, jump off buildings. I think I've been hit by a car like 25 times. That was the easy part. When I saw the movie for the first time at the Cannes Film Market, the masturbation scene, I was disgusted with myself because I didn't know what I looked like on film, and I'm making all these crazy faces. But people love that scene. But I was kind of a method actor at the time too, and I actually wanted to. Because I'm looking at, I think they had a green, you know, green cardboard on the monitor because they were going to key in later what I was supposed to be watching.
Yeah.
And we're in this really small, hot room surrounded by like 25, 30 people. And it's like, all right, you know, come on, Will, get hard or something, you know. And I wanted to, I always wanted to feel, I remember James Gunn would take me aside every once in a while. And because he could tell I was upset with one of my takes, and he's like, "What's wrong?" I was like, "I didn't feel it." He's like, "It doesn't matter." He's like, "It just looks like you did. Don't worry about it." But I wanted to, make that scene real, and I did. I had my hands down my pants, and I just couldn't get into it. And then Debbie Rashan comes over to me and like just touches me on the shoulder or something. I think she said something like, I don't know, to her voice. And all of a sudden, I started to get turned on. I'm like, come on, Lloyd, let's go. Roll camera. And
Debbie Rashawn has that way, like her being around her seems to be a very common theme. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
I've had
she's
the
one
honor
of my favorite.
Of
Yeah.
Oh, she's awesome.
I met her in my first movie.
Debbie Rashawn has worked a couple of horror conventions that I worked, so I got to meet her a couple of times.
She's an amazing person. She also taught me how to cry on camera.
Oh, really? That's awesome. And she's absolutely gorgeous in Romeo and Juliet. Like the camera loves her in that movie. Terra Firma, she's under all this makeup and wigs and stuff, but in that one, she's not.
For my money, she's one of the best things in Terra Firma, too. She's hilarious in that.
Yeah, she is pretty funny in that. Mm-hmm. So, any other questions, Raven, or should
Super
I throw it to
Nathan? Smart girl, talented actress, good person.
Well, and you also got to work with one of our favorites, Tiffany Shepis, who also is a favorite of Sexy Witches. So, you've gotten to work with
That's
a lot
my
of cool
right
people.
There.
Nathan actually had
very,
a question about someone you worked with that he wanted to talk to you about.
Oh, when you were filming Gaslit Love, Johnny X, were you ever on set with Kevin McCarthy?
Yeah, no, I had my scenes with him.
Yeah. Okay. The way it was shot was
behind the scenes pictures.
Like, tell me what working with him is like, because I'm a huge fan of his.
Yeah, he was awesome. He showed up on set. Everyone knew who he was, and me and a few of especially the other actors. And there were plenty of people. I mean, pretty much everyone on the cast and the crew on that movie were like film geeks, you know. So it was. I think it was like 1 or 2 days. Maybe it was just one day. And I think he had passed not long after it.
That was his last appearance.
It was like within a few months or definitely within that year. And so he, you know, I forget how old he was, but he was definitely slowing down, you know, so everyone just kind of catered to him. I actually remember just sitting at his feet, and I didn't want to, you know, bug him too much with questions and stuff, but because the other film nerds were doing that. But it was just cool to kind of soak it in, and someone who'd been in the industry that long with you know, such credits. I forget what number movie that was for me, but it was one of my favorite experiences of working with, because I've worked with celebrities before as an actor and as a producer. But yeah, it was just like, you knew you were in the presence of like history, you know?
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, do you have any questions for our illustrious guest tonight?
I do, actually. Well, I got a couple, but I'm going to limit myself to one. First off, excellent impersonation of Lloyd Kaufman. I've had the pleasure of meeting him a couple times. Yeah. I was wondering.
Here's another one.
Real
quick, here's another one. When something like something bad is always happening on a trauma set, and Lloyd's like, "Oh, it's asshole time." Oh, here we go again. Asshole time.
Oh, my God.
All right, sorry, guys.
That's pretty awesome. I was going to say he just hit some major milestone in his film career, like something like 50 or 60 years he's been doing this. And like you said, so many people come up under him. I was just wondering other than don't yell at someone on the set and make them cry. What you took away from his style or his technique?
Yeah, I mean, so comedy is one thing. He's one of the funniest people you'll meet, and he's like, he's a walking pun machine, you know. And I was not. I mean, I remember someone telling me, you know, the year I graduated NYU, right before I got Tromeo. I remember someone telling me, because I considered myself like a serious actor. I was doing Shakespeare. I was doing all the serious kind of like performance art stuff. And I was dating a girl, and she said, "Don't ever go into comedy, Will. You know, it's not your thing." But I think that was the start. Because then I've done lots of comedies, and people have said I'm funny. But I think that was the start of it. You know, Lloyd kind of allowed, you know, or made me find it within myself, and just, you know, being on set with someone like Lloyd and James, and you know, they're funny people. But he's also he's kind of like master of the soundbite. He's the master at guerrilla marketing, like how to, you know, get your movie known. I remember going to Cannes where every day at 4 o'clock, you know, all the trauma characters, all the PAs would be dressed in Killer Condom costume, Toxic Avenger, all Sergeant Kabuki Man, and then Romeo and Juliet. We'd parade up and down the closet on Cannes and just scream trauma, trauma, and people would run out and hand out flyers. All the PAs would at like 6 in the morning would go into the hotels, all the major hotels on the closet at Cannes, turn into like offices of film companies trying to sell stuff and buyers and sellers. And, you know, you take thousands and thousands of flyers about, you know, when the trauma screens were, and they'd slip them under every door in every hotel that has like 500 rooms, you know. So I learned, you know, a lot about that from him. And on set, although he's a madman, and I'm not, you know, totally down with the style of intimidation and fear, he's really big on safety. And he does. He has a sixth. He has a, because he's been doing it so long, and he's seen everything go wrong, you know, on his own movies and I guess movies that he worked on before Trauma. And you know, maybe there's an argument to be said that a lot of things went wrong because he's running around screaming at people all the time and they're just like shaking and drop something. But he could tell. I mean, he had a sixth sense. He could tell. It's like, no, if you do it that way, then that fucking thing's going to happen. Some asshole's going to do this or that. And we're like, no, Lloyd, don't worry about it. We got it, Lloyd. Don't worry about it. And inevitably, he's always right. He's always right. I don't know how many times I've seen other people and myself where he had this one rule, which I broke on Terra Firma, and I live to regret it. He said, no relationships on set, you know, because it causes too much drama. So
yeah,
I was dating a girl at the time who was a production. She was actually this. She did all the production for the windows at, like, you know, Barney's and Polo Ralph Lauren. And when I got this movie, she wanted me to hire her as the production designer for her first movie. And I was like, no, you don't want to work on a trauma movie. Trust me. But she also, She also knew that I was the lead and it was a love interest thing and so forth and so on. So the poor girl. Anyway, so I hired her because she was the best, you know, and he knew she was the best. But then he came up to me when, and I think he was, and I'm not a liar. I try not to lie only when I'm on camera and I'm schmacking. But he said, Will, are you dating that production designer we just hired? I was like, no, Lloyd, no. He's like, no relationships on set. I was like, no, it's all good. And then this poor girl, although doing the sets in Terra Firma were amazing, she would have to watch me naked with, you know, the leading lady, Elise Lazarell, who was naked and doing things. And that's, you know, that's definitely going to ruin a relationship. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is there anywhere, we always save the ending for plugging your stuff. So do you have anything you want to talk about or plug, or any appearances that I've heard rumor that you do Poe sometimes at St. Babs?
I'll probably be doing that again. Yeah, you know, I've started to kind of come out of my performance shell quite a bit the past, you know, 2 years. I was doing some stuff live. I was, you know, it's also a performance space here. So I was doing, I call it one man Poe around Halloween time. And I just got hired to do something for, like we get grants. We're kind of known as the Arts Church. We get grants from the National Endowment for the Arts, the New Jersey State Council of the Arts, Live Music Society. 350 bands have played here. So I started doing it, but then we got pregnant and we had the baby and then I got into this big property deal. So there'll be a few things coming out, but I encourage everyone to check out St. Babs. That's STBABS Grand Retreat on the Jersey Cape. I think we're on Hip Camp and Airbnb and Verbo.
Nice.
And it's just a beautiful place to, you know, to kind of take sabbatical where spirit and nature are dancing together. And I'm trying to think. I'm involved with a bunch of other stuff outside the church. But it's mainly doing things with other people. check out The Last Sermon, Jack Baxter's movie that I am an executive producer of. I think that can be found pretty much anywhere online at this point. The Last Sermon. And it's a documentary about the refugee crisis. It's a heavy-duty doc, but it's really well-made and really interesting. And the filmmakers, it's kind of following them through through the Middle East and Eastern Bloc countries when all this is going on. Very powerful. And I guess I have one or two movies left in me that, you know, I'm not going to talk about right now that look like they're going to probably happen in the next year or two. And
well, let us
I might just accept one of these offers too, because now I got a baby to support. So I'm taking jobs again. I'm taking jobs, people.
Hire Will Keenan. And real quick, Will, before I let you go for the night, what's your favorite restaurant in Cape May?
Yeah, I was there, believe it or not, for the first time with the seller's real estate agent for the estate.
Nice.
And it was amazing. Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah,
I like Nino's,
rules.
The Italian place in Cape May Courthouse. And then Murasaki, which is kind of like fusion. And then Dos Amigos, best Mexican food on the Jersey Cape. Dos Amigos.
Well, next time I'm in Cape May, we're going to eat at one of those restaurants together.
Right on. All right.
So,
it's a date.
It absolutely is.
Or actually, on St. Babs.
Excellent. So thank you, sir, for coming on the show. We are out of time, so we got to go for the night.
Okay.
So once again,
cool. Thank
you
guys.
You guys
are a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you. Great time. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You sexy bitches. I mean, witches.
we get that a lot.
Yes, we do. So,
guilty as charged.
Right. Good night. So,
good night.
Good night.
Hello,
so tonight. Will Keenan, thank you again for being on the show. And thank you again for Sexy Witches. We are going to take a small Sexy Witch holiday break and take some time off of the radio for a couple of weeks. We should be back on the 13th of July. So that's about 3 weeks from now. And Raven, where can they find you on the interwebs?
Oh, you can find me on TikTok at Frida Krueger. I am on Twitter at Ruben Looney. Come check me out.
And what about you, Aaron?
Let's see. You can find me on Facebook as Winslow Leech. There's three Winslow Leeches. I'm the one currently that looks like Patrick Bateman holding Hounds of Love. So that's how you know it's me. On the Twitter, tweet, you can find me as Captain Antifa, just Antifa, at Aaron Sama 1313.
And Nathan, what about you, sir?
No, I've pretty much been ignoring my social media lately. So go check out Total Psychopathic Wrestling on and come see our show on July 9th. And, yeah, you'll probably see everything I'm doing there or just find me on there.
And you will at some point have a season two of Sell Your Soul at some point, hopefully in the nearer future.
It is in the works. It is the second season is about halfway edited. I just have to find the time to sit down and do it. So.
Yeah, okay. And if you want to find the head huntress, you can find me, actually use my personal profile. It's the best way to find me, Elizabeth Catherine Gray on Facebook. I also manage three groups and of course, the Archivist Witch, that's on Sexy Witches Facebook page, but there's also the Halloween Horror Movie Marathon Madness, which is my annual Halloween group where we do our fiercest film competition on social media. The FB Film Geek Circle, where we talk about general movies overall, and the small but important, especially right now, Rogues of Toshi Station, where we talk about everything from science to science fiction. And, of course, with all the Star Wars shit going down, and Star Trek, for that matter, we've been super busy.
Right.
So, please find us. Thank you for listening. We're going to leave tonight with Eyeball Skeleton and Spooky Mummy Case.
Gonna get stuck in your
y'all.
Head.
Have a good evening and good film hunting and blessed be.
Spooky mommy gave us 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 spooky. Eyeballs were moving, two holes in the wall. Ancient writing on the wall in the hall. It was really spooky and kind of spooky. We heard a voice say,
Spooky mommy gave